Good afternoon. First, I would like to thank Rasha and Koyo and Gabrielle for inviting me to talk today. As Rasha mentioned, my talk today considered the impact of the Tashkent Festival on Soviet translators and audiences, as well as on Western film programmers and critics who came to Soviet festivals. I'm especially grateful to be here because already in conversations with filmmakers who actually showed their films at Tashkent and studied FGIK, I know more about the perspective of filmmakers themselves on the events and screenings that I'll be discussing today. So I will start by quoting from an article in Variety. So in 1974, critic Gordon Hitchens reported in Variety magazine on the third Tashkent Festival of African and Asian Cinema. Along with a detailed report of Palestinian films at the festival, he described at length the perils of translation at Tashkent. Each film was translated live, first into Russian, broadcasted through the theater's loudspeakers over turned down original soundtrack, and then into the languages of the various foreign guests who listened through transistor headphones. The second order translation came up half a minute later than the original utterance, making the narrative very difficult to follow. Despite his frustration, Hitchens praised this ugly Soviet interpreting method because a great number of films in so many languages, often obscure, participate in Tashkent. To Western observers like Hitchens, simultaneous interpreting at Tashkent gave a unique opportunity to view films totally unknown outside their area. That's what Hitchens said. More than that, live translation at Tashkent also helped bring together a great number of non-Western filmmakers to view and discuss their films. It was a forum for African and Arab of geek students to showcase their films and meet other filmmakers from around the world, and made it possible for Soviet audiences to encounter an unprecedented variety of non-Western cinema. Today, I will talk about the simultaneous translation of foreign films as a form of cultural diplomacy. I will focus on a particular stage of Soviet diplomacy, the Tashkent Film Festival, launched in 1968. Some of what I'll be talking about will deal with Arab and African cinema, but I will also talk about the entire range of non-Western films and film networks present in Tashkent, and I will discuss the politics of live translation in the Soviet Union in general and at the Moscow Festival, because Moscow translators later were used in Tashkent as well. And this account is based on several interviews with the earliest surviving simultaneous translators who began their work in the mid-60s. And four of these translators are my relatives, my grandmother, my dad, and his my two aunts. So I will, whenever I talk about them, I will just use first names so not to confuse my audience by saying the last name over and over. So first, a little bit of a history of Tashkent Festival and its impact in the world. As the post-war Soviet Union opened its cultural borders, it aimed to compete with the First World Western powers for the attention of the decolonizing and unaligned third world countries of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. After Joseph Stalin's death, international festivals came one after another, and the first was the Indian Film Festival in 1954, and the second was the International Youth Festival in 1957. In 1959, there came the Moscow International Film Festival and the first Asian and African Film Festival in Tashkent in 1968. Large-scale cinematic international contacts began in earnest in 1957. So this is just to give you guys an idea of how many languages were present in Tashkent. This is a list of filmmakers who would be working with Tashkent delegations in 1968, and you can see that there are languages from Asian countries, but also European languages, and there are no African languages here, but there were filmmakers present with particular African languages as well. And this is the 1957 Youth Festival. So large-scale cinematic international contacts began in earnest in 57, and the festival, this festival demonstrated the two unique features of Soviet festivals: large number of Asian and African participants and voiceover simultaneous translation of films. The International Film Festival, conducted in conjunction with the Youth Festival, included over 125 films from 30 countries, judged by a jury of filmmakers and critics from Western and Eastern Europe, Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The Moscow and Tashkent festivals took place in alternating years, and both used translators from Moscow. Latin American films were well represented in Tashkent as early as 1974, and 2 years later, the festival was renamed as the Asian, African, and Latin American Film Festival. The Moscow Festival also publicized and awarded prizes to films from Senegal, Algeria, Iran, and Latin America, especially Cuba, often for political reasons. Here, I'd like to explain the history of the two festivals and their place in the Cold War film festival scene. From the 60s to the 80s, the Moscow and Tashkent festivals experienced a rise and fall as sources of film for circulation in the West. Almost from the start, Cannes, Berlin, and Venice covered films by some Soviet filmmakers. In the 50s, it was Kalatozov with The Cranes Are Flying. In the 60s and 70s, Andrei Tarkovsky and with Rublev, and Larisa Shepitka with The Ascension. But the reports of the first Soviet international film festivals panned them for bad translations, political bias, officialdom, and mostly bad cinema. And all of that was partially true. Reporting on the first 68 Tashkent festival, Hans Saltink, a Dutch film journalist writing for Variety, attributed amateurish, not to say childish, level of films to the monopoly of Western festivals. Every producer and filmmaker in the world is well aware that when he has good film, it is more lucrative to bring it to Cannes, Berlin, or Venice. The more prestigious Moscow festival could not hope to compete with financial lure of Cannes either. At the same time, Soviet festivals showed a wider range of third world Eastern European and Soviet cinema. Other European, African, Asian, and Latin American festivals provided forums for third world filmmakers to interact with each other and with filmmakers and critics from the West and the Soviet bloc. Karlovy Vary, for example, launched in 66, was the first festival to provide a space for discussion among third world filmmakers. The most international del Cinema Nuova at Pesaro, Italy, began in 68 as a forum for radical third world filmmakers, especially those from Latin America. And Le Journée Cinématographique de Carthage in Tunis, I apologize for my Russian accent, became the center for Arab, Sub-Saharan, and in general, third world cinema organizations. Still, the wide range, a great number of countries and filmmakers participating in Tashkent surpassed all other festivals, including those organized in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In 1974, 45 states sent official delegations to the Tashkent Festival. 32 more nations participated unofficially. Besides the Asian and African representatives, participants included 7 Latin American countries, as well as the United Nations, the Palestine Liberation Organization, and the Liberation Front of North Vietnam. Most participants did not have the funds or the time to provide subtitles in the 3 official festival languages, Russian, English, or French. Simultaneous translation was necessary for them to show films to audiences and to each other. Guinea's Secretary of State for Information, Alpha Amadou Diallo, pointed out in 68 that a Senegalese may have had to travel to Tashkent to see a film made in neighboring Guinea. Already at the conference, Mohamed Aboubakar told me he met and talked to Osman Sidman for the first time at Tashkent. Soviets thus provided a comparative perspective unavailable at major festivals. Cannes, Berlin, and Venice selected films on the basis of their programmers' notions of artistic merit. Soviets placed more emphasis on geopolitical influence and invited popular and political films as well. In the long run, the strategy attracted European programmers interested in discovering new trends, aesthetic and political, in Soviet and Third World cinema. Almost from the beginning, Western programmers came to cultivate informal contacts at Tashkent to find films from the Third World, Central Asia, and the Caucasus to showcase in Europe and North America. Already after 1968 Film Festival, Gordon Hitchens invited several films to the Festival dei Popoli in Italy. In 1972, film historian Jay Leda came to Tashkent to look for African films to show at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. At the 1980 Festival, Berlinale Forum of Young Cinema co-programmer Gerhard Schoenbrenner saw Raguer Mueda, made in Mozambique in 79. He invited the film to Berlin, where it screened in February 1981. By then, Schoenbrenner had become a regular at Tashkent. The same year at Tashkent, Western observers reported discovering a new wave of cinema from Central Asia. The French delegation screened Uzbek directors Ali Kamraev's new films Triptych and Bodyguard for possible purchase. After the festival, Kirsten was on his way to Georgia to check out the latest films. In the following decade, filmmakers from Central Asia and the Caucasus would travel the European and global festival circuits and participate in showcases at venues such as Centre Pompidou in Paris. With the fall of the Soviet Union, Moscow and Tashkent lost their stature in global festival arena. In 85, Charles Cooper, a representative of a British independent film distribution company, Contemporary Films, on his way to Tashkent, told the reporter that he had acquired two Soviet films for distribution at the Moscow Festival the previous year. The two festivals he advised were an essential part of the festival calendar for distributors interested in world cinema. In 95, this was no longer the case. Global art film market found a different focus. But in between 68 and 88, Tashkent made possible collaborations and interactions among African, Asian, and Latin American filmmakers. This photo from an official newsletter shows Staus in interactions at the 80 Tashkent Film Festival. In the melange of In it, you can see the melange of social actors in the Soviet festival scene. It includes Matt Hondo, who brought a widescreen, a Mauritanian director who brought the widescreen musical West Indies, The Fugitive Slaves of Liberty. Hondo was a major figure in the Third Cinema Movement and one of the founders of Pan-African Film Festival of Ouagadougou and the Pan-African Federation of Filmmakers. Meenakshi Anand, an Indian actress who at the time performed in Nepal, also came with the musical film Sandor, a favorite genre of Soviet audiences in general and local Uzbeks in particular. Darijan Chakidze, a Georgian actress, starred in a light comedy. Soviet organizers presented as non-Western, the cinemas from the Caucasus Republics, Georgia, Armenia, and Azerbaijan, and film personalities like Chakidze. The fourth person on the picture is a daughter of Mexican film producer, dancer, and actress Sonia Emilio. She has studied ballet in the Soviet Union and regularly came to the Tashkent and Moscow film festivals. By the late 90s, she had been in the Soviet Union 18 times. In 72, Mexican dance, during her visit to the Tashkent Festival, she appeared in one Uzbek film, made plans to star in another, and launched a joint film venture with Japanese actor-director Yukio Aoshima. And she did all of this unofficially. The Tashkent Festival didn't include Latin American films until 1976. And this is just one example of informal collaborations possible at the festival. Such collaboration and interaction was even more remarkable because the Soviet state closely monitored screenings and encounters with foreign guests. At the Moscow Festival, neither film translators nor film fans were allowed to mingle with foreigners, and KGB curators watched interactions between Soviet staff and invited guests. They also vetted translators who worked with foreigners. The infamous First Department of the State Committee for Cinematography, the main body governing the Soviet film industry at the time, vetted translators who worked with each international delegations and required interpreters to write reports about their activities, including precise place and time of each movement around town. In this translator's report about the visit of Ugandan filmmaker John Bagumira Bingi with his short film Cradle of the Nile in the 65 Moscow Festival, he met with Geek Film School students from Cameroon and Ceylon and also made a speech to the spectators at the screening of his film. After the festival, KGB spies copied foreign representatives' reports on the festival from their own governments. Here's a Russian translation of a report of the West German delegation of the 65 Moscow Festival. It's mostly complained about the size of stands that was given for presentation of their films. And actually is the best example of cultural diplomacy or state involvement in these festivals, these reports, because they're all about, we didn't get as much space, we didn't get the better rooms in the hotel, or we were able to show, like, one of the comments in this particular report is that we showed our film Three Penny Opera that showed that the Soviets are not the only ones who can make movies based on Bertolt Brecht's work. And it's remarkable that they actually thought that Soviets would claim such a unique expertise. Still, in international mingling happened often enough that in 1970, the State Committee for Cinematography denounced violations of procedure for receiving foreign guests by film professionals. The committee reiterated the rules for receiving foreigners at any film institutions and during film festivals. Soviet hosts had to secure an official permission for any contact with a foreigner, provide a precise itinerary, and designate at least two politically loyal persons responsible for the guests. After the visit, responsible persons had to submit detailed reports to their superiors. At the Tashkent Festival, however, everyone stayed in one hotel, and local KGB curators were less interested in surveillance. So the interaction between participants, audiences, and staff was very different. Film translators, local audiences, Soviet filmmakers, and foreign visitors mingled daily. Uzbek filmmakers threw lavish daily parties where guest musicians from Cuba, India, or elsewhere staged impromptu performances. I never saw a festival, remarked a Swiss Catholic Film Commission reporter, where people could spend so much time dancing, singing, and incidentally eating. German critic Hans-Joachim Schlegel reported that press conferences at Tashkent turned into heated discussions that routinely went over the time limit. And this is the round table where the discussions were taking place. An Afghani film critic remembered that during an overnight train trip to Samarkand, festival guests stayed up until 6 in the morning talking. This freewheeling atmosphere was a form of dissent insofar as it departed from the usual furtive socializing constrained by state surveillance. At the Moscow Festival, film translators were not allowed to mingle with foreign guests, but at the Tashkent Festival, where everyone stayed in one hotel and local KGB curators were less invested in surveillance, screen translators could socialize with African, Asian, and Latin American filmmakers and were not asked to write reports. This private photograph is of a simultaneous translator of French, Elena, with the Senegalese actress Younous Ndiaye, invited to the festival as a lead in Osman Simpen's film, The Money Order. At Tashkent, translators could usually escape the political and aesthetic control exerted by the state over their colleagues who read approved film dialogue lists or interpreters who accompanied foreign filmmakers. So now finally, I get to translation. The geopolitics of foreign film spectatorship depended on the practice of two-tiered simultaneous interpreting, which was unique to the Soviet Union. In Russia, simultaneous translation was first used informally during the Sixth Communist International Congress in 1928. Systematic professional simultaneous translation of speeches and testimony dates back to the Nuremberg trials, where each foreign delegation translated the proceedings into its own language and the Americans translated into German. Two-tiered interpreting was a Soviet improvement on the Nuremberg system, which was first used during the 1952 International Economic Congress in Moscow. The system delayed the translation and exacerbated errors, but used fewer interpreters at once and did not depend on translators fluent in two foreign languages. which made it easier to cover more of them. Speeches at the 22nd Communist Party Congress in 61 were translated using the latest equipment to and from 29 languages, including Vietnamese, Indonesian, Korean, and Japanese, as well as Arabic and several rare African languages. As a result, Nikita Khrushchev's famous announcement at the Congress that the current Soviet delegation, current Soviet generation would see the implementation of national communism in its lifetime reached a wider international audience. During the Cold War, all major film festivals required subtitles, but used live translation instead at one time or another unofficially. Beginning with the film program accompanying the 57 Youth Festival, Soviet festivals chose simultaneous film interpreting as a standard. Because of international, because of organizational shortcomings, simultaneous interpreting into Russian over the loudspeaker was often extemporaneous, done without any pre-screening. Written translations of dialogue for reading during screenings were often incomplete or not available. The term interpreting thus applied loosely to the practice. At different times during the same screening, the simultaneous film interpreter into Russian could read from an already translated dialogue list, translate from a dialogue list in a foreign language, interpret directly from the soundtrack, or make up the dialogue when the vocal track was in an unfamiliar language and neither subtitles nor script were available. Foreign guests suffered live translation together with millions of Soviet cinephiles. At all festivals, theaters in Moscow and Tashkent, each film was first translated into Russian, as Hitchens described, played through the theater's loudspeakers and then into the languages of the various foreign speakers, foreign guests, who listened through transistor headphones. That meant that the French-speaking guest would not hear the original soundtrack of the French language picture, but the French translation of a Russian translation, which then came much later than the original. Occasionally, such free-form relay interpretation added humor to the film. I say occasionally, but really often. One foreign journalist reported that he had heard at the Soviet festival the English language expression, "the spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak," translated into a foreign language and then back into English as, "the drinks are pretty good, but the meat is lousy." Such simultaneous interpreting became part of the film. Theorist Michel Chion proposes a notion of emanation speeches in cinema. And here he means actual, directed, intentionally included in films, speech that is not necessarily heard and understood fully, including instances where characters speak one or more languages not translated for the audience. Given that that's how people seen the films, I would argue that this applies to a film shown with simultaneous translation. Foreign guests complained they could not hear original soundtrack behind Russian megaphone translation. Interpreters had to make up scenes when they could not hear or did not know the original language. When they were not quick enough to invent dialogue, their audiences heard incomprehensible speech. So hundreds of foreign and millions of domestic spectators flocked to Soviet festivals to see movies from a position of partial linguistic incompetence. Okay, so now the history of oral interpretation. Oral interpretation of film actually goes back to the early history of cinema. Starting in about 1910, live commentators were interpreting silent foreign films everywhere in the world. The most artful of them, Benshi, dressed in kimonos and took turns performing each character's role on stage to the side of the screen in a sing-song kabuki style accompanied by traditional Japanese string, wind, and drum instruments. Within 5 years, these performers began to use written scripts but interpreting them loosely. In 21, one Benshi amended the line from D.W. Griffith's Orphans of the Storm that said, the French Revolution rightly overthrew a bad government to his own skeptical take on Western democracy. The French political strife was caused by a tradition of bad governing, and the consequences of this were worse. Benshi were so popular and respected that Japanese moviegoers initially rejected sound films, which when they first hit the screens, confined Benshi performances to word-free breaks between spoken dialogue. In the 20s, the Soviet government had circulated silent foreign films in the newly formed Union of Soviet Socialist Republics in mobile cinemas called Kino Peredvizhki. usually accompanied by the political commentary of lecture ideologues. These lecturers condemned the capitalist film producers in their introductions and translated written intertitles, the flashcards that appeared between screens, in a way that omitted ideologically suspect parts. In the same silent era, the bonimenteurs of France, Quebec, and Francophone West Africa stood next to the screen and interpreted intertitles, albeit without fanfare. As late as the 50s, Father Albert van Holt's comic movie shorts featuring Mata Mata and Pilipili, modeled on Laurel and Hardy, introduced Christianity to audiences in rural Congo, accompanied by a translation into the local African language, flowing into the crowd via three loudspeakers. The translation was performed by a local bonimenteur hidden in a nearby van marked Mobile Cinema. The van also transported Belgian missionaries in their 16mm projector from village to village. As silent films became replaced by talkies, live commentators retreated from cinema halls around the world. In many cases, they were chased away by film goers themselves. Middle-class Telugu film goers in Madras, South India, showered their newspaper with complaints about rowdy spectators and about the hawking in the theater of tea and cigarettes, and about Dubashi, Telugu translators of Hindu and Tamil films. The Dubashi, they complained, were indulging in obscenity. One called a mythological character a bastard, translated tragedy as comedy, and flirted from the stage with women in the audience. By then, Banshee too were leaving the cinema stage, forced out by Japanese cinephiles who wanted an authentic experience of Western sound films unadulterated by local tradition. Years later, Abe Mark Norns, a film historian and writer of English subtitles for Japanese movies, called their performances abusive translation. Without it, the dialogue was more accurate, but an afternoon in the cinema became less personal and eccentric. Movie festival translators from the 50s inherited that tradition. To translate a foreign film live in the Soviet Union, one needed only a projector, a loudspeaker, a screen, and an audience. Interpreters usually delivered lines from the back of the cinema hall, never from stage. And sometimes they just leaned against the rear wall. New Year's junkets at government offices and Politburo dachas in Moscow offered the luxury of a chair. Clubs for intelligentsia and screening rooms for the party elite threw in a microphone and headphones. And festival screenings added a table and a lamp to read the foreign dialogue lists, all the spoken lines in the film in chronological order. To be sure, film festivals in Western Europe used simultaneous translators also, but European translators had a minimalist view of live screen translation. Venice Film Festival translator David Snelling, for example, would not have had the translator use any verbal inflections at all, making no distinction between "would you like a cup of tea," "wouldn't a cup of tea be super," or "have some tea." Because he argued that these social distinctions will be abundantly clear from costume and mimicry. Tea within an interrogative intonation is the only minimal disturbance alternative, he argued. The best simultaneous film translators thought of themselves instead in the Soviet Union thought of themselves instead as the practitioners of improvisational sound art. And they spent multiple screenings perfecting their edition of the particular phrase, such as "have some tea." Interpreter Grigory Libergal explained, "When you're watching a film with a simultaneous translation, you, the viewer, have to clearly hear the original soundtrack of the film. If the translator is a master of his craft, he will not dominate the screen, speak on top of the actors. If he's a virtuoso, if he can feel the balance between the film proper and his own voice, after several minutes, the spectator in the theater will forget about the translator, feeling that he himself can understand English, French, or Japanese." This is an ideal description of how it would happen. But in practice, of course, not everybody could do that. So by the late 60s, and here I'm mostly describing what happened in Moscow, because most of my examples are from Moscow, but and then I'll tell about how Tashkent is different. By the late 60s, a pecking order of live film interpreting took shape in the Soviet Union. At the bottom resided the hacks who translated foreign dialogue lists into Russian. Festival administrators doled out these fat jobs to their relatives and friends who didn't know the language as well. They turned in trots with mistakes and omitted scenes. A notch above settled the pedants who failed at ad-libbing. Native bilinguals froze at the mic. Adept metaphrast passed on films unless certain they would get every line. Those invariably signed off with a pretentious interpreted by and then their name. One such person, Zinaida Shatalova, a notable translator of Polish text at the 69 Moscow Festival, refused to take on Andrzej Wajda's comedy, Hunting Flies, about a shy man whose life is turned upside down by a spunky woman he meets by chance. "I don't do youth slang," she declared. Improvisers rated much higher. In an ultimate feat, Illusion lecturer Mark Kushnirovich interpreted an entire movie from a language he didn't know at all. Right before the screening of the 74 Japanese karate picture, Sister Street Fighter, at the 1981 Moscow Festival, the scheduled translator from Japanese was called away to an official function. But canceling the sold-out screening was not an option. This was the first martial arts flick ever to be shown publicly in the Soviet Union. Kushnirovich had seen the film before, but he did not know a word of Japanese. He had to make up the dialogue based on what he could remember from the previous viewings. Grateful spectators gave him an ovation in the end, and the only Japanese speaker who complained to the administration also acknowledged that Kushnirovich conveyed the general meaning of the film, even though he mangled every single line in it. That, he conceded, was one badass translator. Above all stood the maestros who honed every line and inflection over multiple screenings. One, Nelia Nersesyan, inspired cheers from the audience when she spoke in a different voice for each protagonist in 1960 Western The Magnificent Seven. Another, Libor Gal, who you heard from before, learned his craft by studying her inflections. His Russian version of Don Corleone's "I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse" always evoked wild applause. Virtuosos didn't need to sign off with their names. Cinephile recognized them by their voices. True celluloid conundrums required a fusion of freeform and iterative skills. When Wajda's Hunting Flies lost its titled interpreter, Alexander Bondarev, a graduate student in theoretical physics, made his interpretive debut. He ad-libbed some quips for the first few shows, testing each one-liner with audiences until he hit just the right tone. He ended up interpreting at every Hunting Fly screening during the festival. The audience found him and the film a hoot. Three or four times a year at the Moscow Art Cinema Illusion, veteran translators met to foist their impossible standards on novices. They said, "In a virtuoso performance, you would deliver every line just a few seconds after the original dialogue, so those who know the language could hear it. Yet those who didn't would never notice the delay. You'd opt to interpret a new film without dialogue list or pre-screening, anticipating characters' words because you had become one with the director or genre. Yet you'd also love to test your renditions with audiences at repeated shows. Once you found that perfect turn of phrase, you'd never get tired of saying it over and over at 10, 20, or 100 future shows. Spectators would applaud your punchlines and aphorism, idiomatic in Russian, yet they would leave the theater discussing the film as if you, the translator, weren't there, as if they were able to understand the original language." At the Tashkent Festival, such interpreters felt competent to perform as abusive translators, as Norns defined it, to experiment, to tamper with tradition, language, and expectations in order to inventively put spectators into contact with the foreign. The larger world of the festival provided the sensory and institutional context for the cinematic and linguistic transnational contact. In a recent article, Rosin Jagalov and Masha Salaskina proposed to understand the Tashkent Festival as a cinematic contact zone, involving, in Mary Louise Pratt's original definition, radically asymmetrical relations of power. And this is the kind of context where people operated, where translators operated in Tashkent. So at Tashkent, translators from Russian into foreign languages also added their own slant to the dialogue. Gordon Hitchens witnessed such artistry at the screening of an Uzbek film, Riders of Revolution, at the 1968 Tashkent Festival. As Hitchin describes it, the English language earphone translation of the Uzbek original was often very ironic. A wounded Red Army scout escapes from the enemy lines and collapses at the feet of the Bolshevik leaders, as you see here, riddled with bullets and gasping on his last breath. The leader bends down to speak to him, and the voice in the earphones says, "Well now, what's the matter?" in a petulant, irritated voice. Annoying loudspeaker translation served millions of Russian-speaking film fans. Soviet viewers could see Arab and African films and meet the filmmakers not just at Tashkent Festival itself, but also at post-festival screenings at cinema weeks in Central Asia, the Caucasus, Russia, and other Soviet republics. These numerous screenings, more than the few pictures, were much more than the few pictures selected and dubbed for national distribution, and they show the scale of reception of Arab and African cinema in the Soviet Union. For example, Tashkent Film Festival featured the widest selection of Arab cinema: Egyptian blockbusters, shorts by Syrian students from GIK, liberation cinema of Palestine, and more. Arabic was so prominent at the Tashkent Festival that in 1974, Arab participants proposed to make it an official language of the festival, in addition to Russian, English, and French. At Tashkent, mass audiences transformed the embodied context of festival film viewing. This was already evident in Moscow, where during the 65 Moscow Festival, at the screening of My Fair Lady, at the Palace of Sports, every time the interpreter tried to speak over a musical number, all 14,000 spectators stomped their feet and screamed indignantly, "No translation." But that did not compare to Tashkent audiences, especially when local spectators' judgment often contradicted the Soviet political party line. As Father Ambrose Eisenberger, director of film office of the Swiss Catholic Film Commission, described, Uzbek viewers during the 74 festival at Tashkent were even less disciplined than Moscow festival goers. He wrote, "Uzbeks, when they don't like the film, react in a completely normal way. They whistle or leave the theater. Especially during political films, sometimes it was true exodus from the Palace of Arts theater with 2,300 seats. Such unruly spectators," so this is the audience, outside of the palace, and this is the palace. "Such unruly spectators would not be present at the Cannes or Venice festivals close to locals. Instead, active Tashkent viewers resembled festival goers at African and Arab festivals, where anti-imperialist politics did get a warm reception when expressed in a popular genre form. Audience, as Gordon Hitchin reported about the Ouagadougou Festival of Pan-African Film in Upper Volta, now Burkina Faso, audience involvement was maximum, with laughter and applause aplenty for the right moments. Anti-Western put-downs, as well as Algerian, when anti-Western put-downs sounded, as when Algerian guerrillas bested French soldiers in karate combat, were particularly approved. So despite the frequent mistakes, Soviet audiences flocked to films shown at Tashkent. After the 74 Tashkent Festival, the Afghan entry Andarzi Mudar, Mother's Advice, was shown in Dushanbe, the capital of Tajikistan. After the screening, local spectators crowded the Afghan delegation to say that they loved the film. They claimed that they would have understood the film without translation, although the film was in the Pashto language, distinct from the Tajik variant of Persian. So the difference between translation in Tashkent and translation in Moscow is that often the translators were asked to work with films where they didn't know the language and they could only rely on translated dialogue lists and subtitles. But some translators of Arab cinema took great pains to study language and context of the films. In the 60s, this is the exception, but this did happen. In the 60s, Vitaly Naumkin, then a student of Arabic culture and now the director of the Oriental Institute in Moscow, moonlighted as a simultaneous film translator. In his memoirs, Naum Khan describes translating a film, Al Haram, based on a novel by Yusuf Idris. One scene showed the hand of an Egyptian peasant woman breaking an egg on a stone in an open field. Puzzled by this scene, Naum Khan consulted his mentor, an Egyptian communist and ethnographer, Hamdim Salam. Salam explained that the woman was giving birth in secret. Breaking an egg helped her to go through the birth without help of a midwife. Naum Khan remembered that watching Egyptian films was the best primer for him to learn about everyday Egyptian customs. But other film interpreters were not so lucky. Often at Tashkent, interpreters from English or French were asked to translate non-Western films in languages that they did not know from dialogue lists or subtitles. But these promised lists and titles did not always materialize. At the 68 Tashkent Festival, interpreter Kirill was supposed to translate an Iraqi documentary from French subtitles. But when the film began, he saw no subtitles. The only word he could understand was Baghdad. He asked the projectionist to run only the first and last reel, to show only 20 minutes out of 40, but had to invent voiceover for the rest. In what he considered an inspired moment, once during the film, he turned from describing the natural beauty of water reserves, he saw some rivers, to water as a source of energy, and at the next moment, footage of a hydroelectric station appeared on the screen. Such experiences led to nightmares. Translator Natalia had a recurring dream. She enters the film translator's booth and puts on the headphones. The audience is clamoring outside. They can't hear the film. They demand the translation, but she hears nothing. She cannot translate. The foreign film is completely inaudible to her. The story conveys translators' fears of failure, being unable to cope with shoddy technology, failing to relate to an alien culture, confronting an incomprehensible language. But most of all, it shows the fear of failing in their responsibility to the movie-going public. But filmmakers and visitors understood that the Tashkent Festival had to deal with last-minute unsubtitled prints as a matter of course. A Swiss labor newspaper reported complimented Tashkent organizers' ability to account for the possibility of unexpected changes in the program to include a film brought at the last moment at a director's suitcase. In part, that was because Tashkent welcomed filmmakers in exile or from countries under dictatorship or in turmoil who often had to carry film reels with them. In that, it resembled, for example, a Havana festival in 79, where Latin American filmmakers came with the films in their hands. And where schedules for screenings were tentative until the date of screenings, and many films had no subtitles or translation facilities. Indian filmmaker Devendra Kumar carried to Tashkent his documentary India's Struggle for Freedom with only a Telugu vocal track. Film was shown and understood without translation, he reported, because its universal theme matched the purpose of the festival. Just as translators expected their audiences to intuit, together with the translator, what was said on the screen in the language they did not know, so did translators themselves plunge into the unknown in perceiving foreign speech. During tours to Soviet republics after the festival, each translator was usually given two films to translate live in a language he or she knew, and two films, for instance, in an African dialect to translate from a script. I learned, recalls translator Elena, that when you translate such a film for the 20th time, you begin to soak in that culture, and it was useful to not just experience the familiar European culture, but something else. Often the dialogue lists were missing several scenes, but by the fourth or fifth time, I would invent translations of these scenes for myself. My grandmother, Kira, told me that she once translated an African film from a French dialogue list during a film festival. Unfortunately, by the time she told me the story, she no longer remembered what country or language it was, but she was 90 at the time. A diplomatic representative of this country was in the audience. 10 minutes before the end, the script was over. The film goes on in an African language she does not know. She has nothing to say. An administrator storms into her booth predicting a diplomatic crisis. To save the situation, she went ahead and composed the dialogue for the rest of the film on the basis of the moving images. She remembers that after the film, the African dignitary, made aware that the dialogue list was too short, was nice enough to thank her for making up the end. He claimed that it was quite close to the original. In that particular place and time then, live simultaneous translation by a conscientious and invested commentator, whether by ear or sight, was an acceptable, was as acceptable to audiences as an official written script or subtitles, and it was sometimes even preferable. The important thing, Kira claimed, was that the audience felt that it had the experience of understanding the film. So to conclude, the Soviet government created the Tashkent Festival to position the Soviet Union as a gateway to film cultures of postcolonial Asia, Africa, and Latin America. To that end, they emphasized multinational participation and mass local viewership over aesthetics. The festival thus employed scores of simultaneous film translators working in dozens of languages, more than any other international cinema showcase. This phenomenon allows us to understand the ways translation produces new forms of social life. To be open to a flawed encounter with the foreign, theorist Naoki Sakai proposes a notion of heterolingual address, meaning a fundamental determination of your addressee as the one who might not comprehend your language, that is, of the foreigner. The Soviet Translation Project aimed to produce transparent communication within a stable geopolitical hierarchy, enshrining differences between languages, cultures, and the three worlds, capitalist, socialist, and non-aligned. The project succeeded only in part. Artisanal and inexact practice of live interpreting made assembly line approach impossible. Visitors who expected homolingual linguistic transparency left very disappointed. But those who adopted a heterolingual approach to the rampant inefficiencies of the project made discoveries aesthetic and political. Thank you.